Shalom and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor to Israel Policy Forum. So as I'm sure you're all aware, we just saw another escalation of violence between Israel and the Gaza Strip over the past week, a five-day mini round between the IDF and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. To help us understand what just happened and what it could mean going forward, we have back with us Colonel in the Reserves, Dr. Michael Milstein, one of Israel's foremost experts on the Palestinians. Michael is, of course, the former head of the Palestinian Arena in Israeli military intelligence, an advisor to the IDF general responsible for the Palestinian territories, the head of the Palestinian Studies Center at the Dayan Center at Tel Aviv University, and a senior researcher at the Institute for Policy and Strategy at Reichman University. But first, a few thoughts from me. So we'll get into security and Palestinian affairs in just a second with Michael, but it's worth, I think, dwelling for a minute on just how strange life is here in Israel. Now, I know what you're probably thinking. Thanks, Neri. Cool. Very informative. Tell us something we don't already know. But all kidding aside, it was striking, at least to me, just how quickly life in Israel and the public debate shifted back to quote-unquote normal after the Gaza ceasefire was announced late Saturday night. By Sunday morning, literally, the conversation was back to domestic politics, the bloated budget the government is about to pass, the slowing economy, the judicial overhaul, et cetera, et cetera. It was as if the previous day's rocket fire and red alert sirens didn't happen at all, or at least happened in some faraway mythical place. The media coverage of Operation Shield and Arrow, as it was known in Israel, was constant. It was 24/7, with running debates about Israel's Gaza strategy, the relationship between the different Palestinian factions, the past and future of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict writ large, and then, poof, it was all gone. Back to business as usual, internal politics. On the one hand, I can understand the impulse. There are legitimately a lot of major domestic issues going on. But the question is, at least to me, why is it that the Israeli political and media class, and by extension, the Israeli public, only talk about the Palestinians and the Palestinian issue when there's a military operation on, when rockets are falling, and when bombs are going off? And when they're all not, it's out of sight and out of mind again, until the next escalation. Speaking of which, we're recording this Wednesday afternoon. Tomorrow is the start of Jerusalem Day, marking the Israeli conquest slash reunification of East Jerusalem in the 1967 war. And with it, the controversial far-right flag march, or dance of flags, through the Muslim quarter of the Old City. There's a possibility, and I get into this with Michael later on, that this could all lead once again to renewed violence, either in Jerusalem, the West Bank, or even, dare we say, with Gaza again. So just take this into account that by the time this podcast goes up, we may be all, once again, talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the different Palestinian factions and IDF operational capabilities and the like, until the guns fall silent once again, after which it'll be right back to regular programming, unfortunately. Let's get to Michael Milstein. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the Israel Policy Pod.
Hi, Neri. Thank you for inviting me.
It's really our pleasure, Michael. So last time you were on was a little over a year ago, for those who remember, late March 2022, which was the start, really, of this wave of terror attacks inside Israel and growing violence and instability in the West Bank. But this time, obviously, I wanted to invite you back on to focus on the most recent escalation in Gaza and with Gaza. So probably worth recapping for everybody before we get into it. Early last Tuesday morning, the IDF killed three senior commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad group in Gaza via targeted airstrikes within just a few seconds of each other. And this set off 5 days of fighting between the IDF and PIJ, as it's known. All told, over 30 Palestinians were killed. According to the IDF, nine of these were non-combatants, including women and children, along with 21 militants that were killed. Gazan authorities claim a slightly higher figure for civilian deaths, but also three Gazans were killed by failed rocket launches, which crashed inside the Strip. There were two fatalities inside Israel from rocket fire. One 80-year-old woman in Rehovot died after a rocket crashed into her apartment block, and one actually Palestinian man from Gaza who was working inside Israel. He was killed as well. And a ceasefire, as we all probably know, came into effect late Saturday night, as always brokered by Egypt. So, okay, Michael, with all that said, let's set the table. This was obviously the second round of open conflict between Israel and the jihad in 9 months since last August, and the third round of open conflict with the jihad since 2019. So first question to you, were you surprised that we had this latest escalation last week?
Well, unfortunately, Neri, I wasn't surprised because I think that, as you mentioned before, this last round of escalation wasn't so unique event. Actually, we see similar events repeat themselves. And you mentioned the operations last August and in 2019. And we are in the same pattern, with two basic phenomena. First of all, that Israel confronts directly the Islamic Jihad, and second, that Hamas is sitting or prefer to sit on the fence and not to be involved in this kind of clash, in this kind of conflict. And I think, Neri, that this kind of or this pattern of conflicts, which, as I mentioned before, do not surprise me at all, actually reflects two basic phenomena or insights regarding Gaza. First is that the Hudna, the Hasdara in Hebrew, or the political settlement, political economic settlement that was based in Gaza during the last two years, is full of holes, full of strategic holes, and actually cannot provide Israel total calm or total quiet, mainly because Hamas doesn't feel that that it is committed to fulfill total or completed quiet in this area. And the second point is that Israel or such an operations reflect that Israel has actually no strategy regarding Gaza for long years. Actually, when you are checking the policy of the current current government and the former governments and the governments that were before, they got the same formula, they got the same policy of keeping Gaza calm, and even they are even ready to pay a lot of strategic prices in order to achieve this goal. And there is a very little thinking about the long-term vision about Gaza. And unfortunately, we're speaking today about mainly Hamas, the prominent player in Gaza, which has a long-term vision and a long-term strategy and a multi-dimension strategy, while in the same time, Israel has no strategy. And Israel actually is focused only in moves that are focused or are aimed to achieve a quiet or stable situation in Gaza.
Okay, I like you came out firing, Michael. This is good. We're going to get into the longer term strategy, at least on Israel's part, and also, by the way, on Hamas's part, in just a second. But with regard to this particular operation, which we saw last week, the context, at least from the Israeli point of view, was the week prior, we had about 100 rockets fired on southern Israel, primarily Shderot, after a Islamic Jihad senior leader or figure, maybe it's more accurate to say, died in Israeli prison after an 86-day hunger strike. Mm-hmm. We also had... basically in April during Ramadan and Passover, we had a rocket fire not only from Gaza, but southern Lebanon and Syria. So this was, I would argue, the backdrop, at least militarily, of what Israel chose to do. And then, like I said, Netanyahu and his government and the security chiefs decided to take the initiative, as they said, the initiative and surprise.
That's right.
And at least in military and operational terms, it may be deemed a success. This last operation, six senior jihad commanders were killed. Israel was able to exhibit very impressive intelligence capabilities tracking these guys down. We had Iron Dome, and not only Iron Dome, also David Sling shooting rockets out of the skies pretty successfully. Netanyahu called this a change in the equation vis-a-vis Islamic Jihad in Gaza, maybe other enemies. It seems like you're quite skeptical. But just in terms of Islamic Jihad in Gaza, how would you rate this latest operation just in, I guess, military terms?
Well, actually, your question leads us, Neri, to the question of the general strategic balance of this operation. And as you yourself mentioned before, the whole balance is quite mixed, because on the one hand, the PIJ really suffered dramatic, painful damage. The elimination of the six senior members. I think that, you know, since 1995, the elimination of the founder of the PIJ, Fathi Shkaki, I think that this organization didn't have such a severe damage. And of course, you also mentioned it, their whole military moves were very poor, very, very limited, and they didn't succeed to expand the conflict to other arenas. By the way, this failure of expanding the conflict to the West Bank, to Jerusalem, maybe even to the Arab sector in Israel, caused a lot of frustration, a lot of anger among Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, that complained that while they are bleeding in Gaza, in the West Bank, the daily life are really ordinary. And I would add to the to this analysis also other positive points from the Israeli point of view. For example, the fact that there was no heavy external international pressure on Israel, and the consolidation of the Israeli society around the conflict. We all remember that we are still in a very painful, deep crisis inside Israel, the debate about the judicial reform. But although this rift, this painful crisis, the whole Israeli society actually united around its leadership in this conflict. But on the other hand, we have two strategic gaps. We mentioned or described all the military achievements, but we have two strategic gaps. First of all, this conflict, this round of escalation, was longer than what Israel planned or what Israel assessed. I assess that Israel planned maybe 1 to 2 days of clashes, military clashes, and there was almost 5 days, almost a week of clashes. And second, and more seriously, we mentioned it before, all the issue of the Hudna, of the political settlement. You know, the concept, the perception that if you will improve the economic situation in Gaza, maybe you will cause Hamas to understand that there is a lost price, and maybe the public in Gaza will promote pressure on Hamas and the Islamic Jihad to avoid or to stop any round of escalations. And this concept actually was failed. We found that there is a hole in this way of thinking. And I think that, you know, many people in Israel, they are trying to describe the sitting on the fence, Hamas sitting on the fence, as a strategic achievement. I personally do think that it's wrong, because this is a failure. You know, and I think that this is the actually the sources of the next escalation, because if Hamas will still sit on the fence, it means that the Islamic Jihad and other factions in Gaza will be very active and very provocative against Israel. So there is no change in the basic formula regarding Gaza. And there is another point, Neri. You also mentioned that many political or even military figures in Israel describe this operation as a success to strengthen Israeli deterrence toward the players in Gaza and maybe to change the rules of the game in Gaza. And I personally must admit that I see no change. I do not think that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad had new lessons about what should be done in the future in Gaza. I don't think that they are more deterred to promote provocative moves toward Israel or to change their policy. And I do think that it is mainly the gap between the way the Israelis or the Israeli leaders see the operation and the results of the operation and the way the other side, the Palestinian one, analyzed this event.
So a lot to unpack there, but let's start here. By the way, I should mention that I agree with you in the sense that it was very important and not a given when this operation was undertaken by Netanyahu and his government that Israeli society would be united, that everybody would for the most part support the campaign. And so that in and of itself was, I think, important, not only for the actual campaign, but also to project outwards, given...
Actually, for about a week, Neri, the whole protest, the popular protest in Israel was limited or even halt for about a week, not more than that.
Yeah. I mean, now this week it's back in a big way, but
yeah.
But yes, the organizers stopped the traditional Saturday night rallies, especially in Tel Aviv. Benny Gantz and Yair Lapid, the opposition leaders, came out in support of the government and the campaign in Gaza. So in and of itself, domestic politics actually were shored up, especially again, given the backdrop of the last 5 months and the deep, deep division. Right. But I wanted to ask you about the thesis that we've heard now for several weeks, if not months, that about the potential for a multi-front war, right? That we were told for many weeks that the ring of fire, quote unquote, around Israel, these Iranian-backed militias and proxies, whether it's the south from Gaza or the north from Lebanon or Syria or even beyond Syria, were closing in on Israel. The circle was tightening, and that potentially in any future escalation and crisis, whether in Jerusalem, the West Bank, or Gaza, that Israel was running the risk of igniting all these fronts all at once. That didn't happen.
That's
at all,
right.
This time around. That not only did Lebanon and Syria and the West Bank and Jerusalem stay very, very quiet, but in Gaza, like you said, Hamas stayed out of it. They couldn't even really get a united front inside Gaza. So I'm curious, number one, were we, I guess, overrating the chances of a multi-front escalation? And then number two, the question that we all ask and that we hear again and again, what was Iran's role in all of this, given the fact that they are the prime and sole backers of the Islamic Jihad group?
Well, I will start with the first question, Neri, regarding the multi-fronts conflict. And, you know, during the last week, I spoke with a lot of Palestinians, friends, mainly in Ramallah, and I asked them the same question. Israel, for about a month, even more than a month, was very much concerned about, channeled to a conflict in several fronts in the same time, and that didn't happen. And I was wondering why actually the Palestinians failed to in this mission. And the answer was very interesting, because they told me it is not a failure of the Palestinians, it's a failure of the Islamic Jihad. The fact that the Islamic Jihad was the prominent player in this round of escalation made a lot of Palestinians, mainly Palestinians, not to be so enthusiastic and not encourage this kind of escalation. We should remember that the Islamic Jihad is a small organization with a small or very limited popular support and almost zero civil infrastructure. So they all told me, you should not, Israel should not learn from this round of escalation a lesson that says that in the future there will be no multi-fronts conflict. Because, for example, they told me that if, for example, Hamas will be the prominent player, maybe we will see not only a front that will be inflamed in the West Bank, Jerusalem, or even the Arab sector in Israel, but also in South Lebanon, exactly as we saw about a month ago when Hamas launched rockets from Lebanon to the Galilee. And as to the other question about Iran, I do think that we here in Israel are describing Iran in let's call it an exaggeration of the Iranian role in this specific conflict, but also in a lot of other events and phenomena. Because I do think that, of course, the Iranians are trying to promote all kinds of violent and negative moves against Israel in several measures in various fronts. But you don't have to find or to describe the Iranians as a responsible player in every event. For example, in the last round of escalation in Gaza, of course, the Iranians supported the Islamic Jihad. They encouraged them to continue with the fighting. But the decision about the continuation of the fighting or regarding Hamas sitting on defense was not a result of Iranian orders. It was a result of Palestinian decisions. And I think that sometimes when you put the name Iran in the end of every sentence in Hebrew or in the end of every analysis you do, you miss the capability to recognize what is the real problem. And here it's the real problem was that Hamas, who is totally and no doubt the prominent player in Gaza, was not ready to stop the Islamic Jihad. It was not a result of Iranian push. It was a result of Hamas policy, and this is the problem. So that's why I think that we should be very, very cautious in the way we describe the Iranian role in every violent event Israel is involved in.
So I think this is an important point to emphasize, that it's not a case of there's a phone call from Tehran to Gaza City or Gaza City via Beirut, the Islamic Jihad leadership, and that they tell them to start firing or to stop firing, that you're saying it's a lot more localized and Palestinian interests and calculations that go into
it. It's a much more matter of Palestinian consideration and not of the Islamic leaders in Iran targets.
Okay. So I think this is an important point, again, to emphasize. You obviously hear different types of voices, both here in Israel and other places, arguing that these escalations in the Israeli-Palestinian arena begin and end with decisions in Iran, which is, right. I'd agree with you, not the case. Let's turn to Islamic Jihad itself, Michael. Mm-hmm. It seems like you were a bit less impressed by their showing over the past week. I have to say, my assessment may be a bit more mixed. You know, especially this round coming just 9 months after the last round, when everyone, you know, we were all told by Israeli security officials and politicians that Islamic Jihad had suffered, you know, the hardest hit in its history, that, you know, the round last August took the group back, you know, years, I guess years turned into months, and then it decided that it could still stand up to the IDF, at least for a couple of days. So I was actually a bit maybe more impressed by the fact that they were able to at least keep up some sporadic rocket fire into Israel and also up to and including Tel Aviv and southern Tel Aviv suburbs. But I was even more impressed by something that came up maybe by accident or maybe by strategic choice. And we saw this right at the beginning of the escalation last week, where Islamic Jihad waited a day and a half, 36 hours after its first, you know, the targeted strikes by Israel, and the three senior commanders were killed. But Jihad waited 36 hours until it fired the first rocket.
That's right.
And over the course of the next, 3 to 4 days, you saw these heavy barrages, followed by many hours sometimes of quiet, followed by some heavy barrages. And so all told, this was basically a war of attrition, that many people were calling it, where Islamic Jihad, without firing one rocket, kept basically all of southern Israel under siege. You know, tens of thousands of Israeli residents of southern Israel left their homes. And even up to and including central Israel, that was still on heightened alert and waiting for sirens and waiting for rocket fire. And so I thought that was actually something new and something quite effective, that they were going for longevity of the campaign and maybe not the intensity of previous rounds. Am I missing something? Is this new, or am I overrating this war of attrition model?
Basically, I think I agree with you. I would agree with your description, Neri. And you know, I do think that we should pay attention only to one thing which was different, and this is the length of this conflict. We mentioned it before. It took, I think that it is the longer round of escalation Israel and the PIJ had ever have between them, 5 days. And you know, it's a very odd situation. And I think that because, or as a result of this severe damage of loss of three of their senior figures in the beginning of the operation, this was actually the reason why they wanted this conflict to be longer than the other conflicts in the past, that the other rounds of escalations in the past, because I do think that they wanted to demonstrate that they do have the sumud, you know, the strong standing in spite of all the damages that they suffered from. They can still fight, even if it's in a very limited manner or with very limited military successes. And I do think, you know, that when we are trying to summarize or to analyze the whole operation, it is quite odd that a regional superpower like Israel should find itself again and again in a direct conflict with a B-League terror organization like the Islamic Jihad. And as you mentioned before, this B-League terror organization actually affected the daily life in Israel, or more in most of the parts of Israel during also a week. And I think that when we speak again about strategy, about strategic analysis of what is happening in Gaza, Israel should not consider or define its efforts or its policy as focused in the Islamic Jihad, because the Islamic Jihad, you know, it's a minor player in Gaza. We should concentrate in Hamas, which is no doubt the prominent player, the player that decides when or if there will be escalations in Gaza. Israel should not find itself once again in a direct conflict and direct clash with an organization such as the Islamic Jihad. I think that strategically it's very wrong.
And now a brief message from Israel Policy Forum staff members.
We are facing a watershed moment, not only in Israel's history, but also in its ties with the United States and American Jews.
The Israeli government's policies, which raise serious questions about the tenor of the country's democracy,
prevent a two-state outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and promote a narrow version of Jewish identity, undermine our shared values,
and Israel's role as the state of the Jewish people.
At a time when U.S. Israel and Israel diaspora ties face existential challenges, Israel Policy Forum's role as a trusted and reliable voice has never been more essential.
We are producing credible, timely policy analysis
on issues shaping Israel's future as secure, Jewish, and democratic.
From the judicial overhaul to West Bank settlements to Israel's regional ties.
Our articles, explainers, podcasts, webinars, and other policy content serve as go-to resources for policymakers and individuals seeking to understand the latest developments.
In Washington, we brief members of Congress and key administration officials
to help them understand the realities on the ground in Israel as they navigate threats to the foundation of the U.S.-Israel relationship.
We are partnering with organizations across the American Jewish communal landscape
to provide curated educational programming rooted in our policy resources and expertise.
Through IPF Atid, we are building the next generation of North American leaders committed to Israel's democracy and to a two-state future.
And fostering ties with Israeli peers on the front lines of the fight for democracy.
As American Jews, we have a responsibility to act when Israel's future is at stake. Now is the moment to stand up for the Israel we need.
Secure,
Jewish,
and democratic.
Let's get into Hamas. And its role, yeah. Its role in all this. As you said, Hamas is the sovereign and the authority and the government in Gaza, and has been since it took power through a violent coup in 2007. It's the bigger and stronger militant group, especially relative to PIJ. And like we mentioned earlier, like last August and in 2019, Hamas chose to stay out of this fight and left Islamic Jihad alone on the battlefield against the IDF. To my mind, there are a lot of competing theories as to the relationship between Hamas and the Islamic Jihad. And I'd love to get your point of view, Michael, as also a former intelligence officer. So some contend that Islamic Jihad is a spoiler. It has no governing responsibilities, unlike Hamas, and that Hamas is perfectly happy to let the IDF hammer Islamic Jihad and to kind of hammer it into submission and down to size. Others contend that Islamic Jihad is a very useful agent of mukawama, of resistance, for Hamas to send out there every few months, every few years to attack Israel, while Hamas sits on the sidelines and, like we said, reaps the economic and financial benefits of its arrangements and negotiations with Israel, and that Hamas basically gives Islamic Jihad a green light or maybe even an orange light to attack Israel and to launch these escalations. So where do you come down on this debate, or am I missing something in terms of the Hamas-Islamic Jihad relationship, which is so interesting?
You know, the point you elaborated, it's very important and very, very interesting, because it relates not only to, you know, strategic analysis, but also to the world of images. Because when you think about the discourse in Israel and maybe even in the regional or the international arenas, and you are speaking about the images, you can see a very popular image of Hamas and the Islamic Jihad as two players that compete each other, that hate each other. Some people in Israel also describe the PIJ, Islamic Jihad, as a challenge to Hamas, and are trying to describe how difficult it's to Hamas to impose its control over the PIJ. They even describe Hamas as a player which really enjoys when he sees Israel hitting the PIJ. And I personally, and this actually relates to your analysis about the two theses, I'm much more close to the second thesis, because I do think that the whole image of separation between the Hamas and the Islamic Jihad is quite false. I think that it is a manipulative image of Hamas, who really has the power to stop, to halt, to inflame every escalation in Gaza, but really prefer not to do it, to do this, because Hamas really really tries actually to combine or to achieve two contradictive targets or pillars. First of all, to preserve a resistance space in Gaza, but on the other hand, also to not to be channeled to a direct conflict with Israel, and most important than all, to enjoy all the economic, social fruits that are included in the Hasdara, in the Hudna with Israel. And I think that, you know, Israel should not be mistaken by this twisted image. The reality is quite different from the popular image. Reality, the situation itself is very, very clear. Hamas has the capabilities to impose its control over all the factions in Gaza, including the Islamic Jihad. And Israel should not, portray this situation in a manner that actually helps Hamas and do not assist Israeli interests.
So very, very interesting, Michael, because like you said, we heard the other side of the theory come to the fore, especially over the past week, where Israeli military chiefs and even political leaders and definitely commentators said, you know, well, Hamas is very happy about Islamic Jihad getting hammered by the IDF. Hamas is on purpose staying out of this, that it's not joining in, and that's a strategic goal or benefit for Israel, and that it's very important to keep Hamas out of this and just focus on Islamic Jihad. You're saying that not only is that mistaken, but it's a mistake.
That's right.
For Israel to actually accept this thesis.
And this kind of thinking, Neri, I think that, you know, the roots of the next escalation, you can find them in this kind of in this pattern of thinking, because if you let Hamas and let the Islamic Jihad to understand that nothing was changed and Hamas can still sit on the fence and the Islamic Jihad can still promote provocative moves against Israel, it means that the next round of escalation will occur quite soon. And there is no deep deterrence of both players from Israeli moves.
So let's get into that issue, Israel's overall Gaza strategy. I know you've written about it, I've written about it, that mm-hmm. at least for several years, but to my mind, really since about 2018, the idea, at least on the Israeli side, was that we're going to give really unprecedented economic and financial and humanitarian benefits to Gaza, i.e. to Hamas that controls Gaza. Things like Qatari money, worker permits for Gazans to enter Israel for the first time since Hamas took over. Now it's over 17,000 workers from Gaza come into Israel to work. Right. We're going to expand what we allow to be imported into Gaza and to be exported out of Gaza. And in return, Israel asks Hamas one thing, and that's quiet. Quiet from Hamas directly, and also Hamas as a sovereign of Gaza to keep quiet the other groups, the smaller groups like Islamic Jihad, and to stop them from firing rockets. What you said, to impose their will on the other smaller groups. And there have been moments of real quiet. The problem is, like we've been talking about now for about 30 minutes, is that we've now had four rounds of conflict with Gaza since 2019. And even mm-hmm. even worse than that, the time between each round has been shortening. That's gotten to the point now where literally the IDF and Israel fought against Islamic Jihad 9 months ago. And here we are now talking about another round with Islamic Jihad. So I understand that you're somewhat skeptical about this overall strategy, about what you call the Hasdara, the Hudna, the arrangement between Israel and Hamas over Gaza. What, I guess my question is twofold. Number one, what more needs to be done in order to maybe uphold this arrangement, right? Or maybe taking a step further, and number two, what are the other alternatives, right? That if the only thing Israel really wants from Gaza is quiet, and that this is the way to ensure quiet, short of reoccupying the Strip, what would you recommend the decision makers do?
So I will elaborate, Neri, a united, complex answer for both both questions, because as you described it correct, there are a lot of holes in the formula that Israel attempt to promote during the last 2 years. Actually, Israel, I think that it was a wishful thinking of Israel, really to believe that by economy, good economy, a permit to workers to get out of Gaza and merchants and promoting civil projects and salaries to the public sector, you will achieve a much more calm situation in Gaza. And this formula, let's face it, let's admit it, it failed. It failed because I think that Israel was not strict enough in its policy toward Hamas regarding any violation of this situation. I think that here in Israel, 3 days or 4 days after the end of the operation, this round of escalation in Gaza, we must think about ways to redesign the Hasdara, the Hudna, with Hamas, because if we will not change the current formula, it's obvious that we will find ourselves again and again and very soon in the same event. And I think that first of all, Israel should not permit Hamas to dictate rules of the game, the rules of the Hasdara. Right now, Hamas policy or Hamas perception about the Hasdara says that Hamas will keep situation in Gaza quite calm. Hamas itself will not initiate any military act against Israel, but in the same time, and from Gaza itself, it can promote terror attacks in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in other fronts which are not Gaza. And I really think that after suffering so many terror attacks in the West Bank during the last year, we must stop this phenomena. Second, and of course, in a very direct connection to the last round of escalation, of course, we must push Hamas to impose its control over the other factions in Gaza, and mainly the PIJ. And third, I think that we must promote pressures on Hamas to demonstrate much more flexible policy regarding the issue, the painful issue of the missing soldiers and civilians that are in the hand of Hamas in Gaza. I do remember, Neri, that after the operation that took place in May 21, Israeli government promised that any economic move that will be promoted toward Gaza is conditioned by progress in the negotiations over the soldiers and civilians that are in the hand of Hamas. And of course, it didn't take place. And I think that from this day, Israel should condition the exit workers, the salaries, the export and the import out of Gaza and to Gaza, and every economic and infrastructure move in the policy of Hamas. And of course, if there will be violations of Hamas, as the one we mentioned before, Israel should limit or punish Hamas. I do think that, you know, right now, Yehiel Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza, really doesn't believe that Israel is serious enough and that Israel will punish him if there will be any violations. And you know, after a week of military clashes, only this Sunday, immediately after the cease of the fire, Israel opened again the gates of Gaza and let workers from Gaza to get out of Gaza to Israel. And I think that it really means, in the eyes of Iris and Wow of Hamas, that Israel is not serious enough, is not strict enough. And if you do want to demonstrate or to make it clear to Hamas that you are serious enough and that there is a loss price to every move, I think that Israel should explain that its basic policy toward Hamas was changed, and maybe it will cause clashes and maybe it will cause military tension. But I think that in the end of the day, it will make Hamas understand that Israel is much more serious in the past, and maybe it will make the number or the rate of rounds of escalations between Israel and the organization in Gaza much more limited. So I do think that Israel should be much more brave, much more strict in this point, if our policy, Israeli policy or strategy, is to achieve less tension on the long term with Gaza.
So it is interesting, right, that in April during Ramadan and the Pesach and Passover, that we had rockets from southern Lebanon that were fired, according to Israeli intelligence, by Hamas militants and cells in southern Lebanon. And that in response, Israel struck Hamas in Gaza, struck military targets in Gaza. So, and by the way, Islamic Jihad also apparently fired rockets during that little escalation in April. And so back in April, the address, quote unquote, for the escalation from Gaza was actually Hamas. And then a month later, this past week, the address, the sovereign in Gaza, was no longer Hamas, that Israel was focused solely on Islamic Jihad. It was definitely a shift that I noticed.
Yeah.
The address had shifted.
That's right.
But I'm going to play a little devil's advocate. I'm going to put on my Yahya Sinwar hat. Because you know what Sinwar is going to say and how he's going to respond, that if Israel becomes a lot stricter and starts taking things away for any violation, whether Hamas or, like you said, a smaller group like Islamic Jihad, that he's going to escalate like he has in the past.
And that's right.
And it's almost inevitable. And you're saying Israel has to be ready to take that risk. And even if it means a longer and sustained campaign, like we saw even maybe in 2014, which was a 2-month war.
That's right. But you know, Neri, when you analyze it logically, when Israel promotes a new policy, I mean the Hasdara, there is still rounds of escalation. And as we described it right now, if Israel will change the rules of the game, there will be escalation. So actually, in every scenario, there will be escalation. And I think that it is better that Israel will find itself in a much much more strict, much more serious stand in future scenarios. And I do think that maybe a clash will happen after Israel will promote or limit the economic moves toward Gaza. But I think that in the day after this round of escalation, Hamas will understand that Israel is not ready to pay any price in order to preserve the calm situation in Gaza. And I think that maybe it will be much more cautious regarding the situation in Gaza, and either try to impose much more seriously its control over the other factions in Gaza. Because right now, I think that it is really the current formula is really ridiculous. Israel is channeled to a direct conflicts and direct clashes with small organizations in Gaza. Israel suffers from rounds of escalation, whether workers are getting out of Gaza and whether they are not. So I do think that this is a time for initiatives. And first of all, we must clear that the current formula. We want to change some things in the current formula and to redesign again the whole concept of the relations between economy and security.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I can imagine how Sinwar will react. But again, like you said, it may.
Yeah, me too, by the way. Me too. But you know, this is the Middle East. This is the language people speak. It's quite old to speak with people like Yahya Sinwar in Western language and to convince them that you know, good economy and good life, it's better than promoting your radical ideology. But
yeah.
You know, there are different people in the Middle East.
Yeah, I could do a whole hour just on the figure and strategy of Yahya Sinwar, but we'll save that for a future episode. Michael, just on the point of maybe rethinking Israel's entire strategy for Gaza and the arrangement and the Hudna, how, to the best of your knowledge, how widespread is that understanding or that realization right now, you know, at the higher echelons of either the Israeli army or government? Is there an understanding that their strategy for Gaza may be on the verge of collapse if it hasn't collapsed already? Or are they patting themselves on the back and saying, well, we just hammered Islamic Jihad, they're now deterred for a longer time, we've sent a message to Israel's other enemies, whether Hamas or Hezbollah, that we have these capabilities and that, you know, this operation was a success and we can bank on at least a year plus of quiet. What do you understand from the Israeli decision makers?
Yeah, and let's hope that I do not mix, you know, between wishful thinkings and assessments. But, you know, when I'm checking, Neri, the general situation in Israel during the last 4 years, I must admit, you know, I can be critic toward a lot of issues and points, but I must admit that Israel is not ready to promote or to crystallize any unique or interesting policy, because first we are really focused on the internal crisis in Israel. For about 4 years and four elections, and second, there are really other bigger problems such as the Iranian nuclear program and even the Hezbollah threats from in the northern arena. So I do think that maybe you can think about other ways to promote your policy regarding Gaza, but I do understand that there are a lot of other considerations regarding it, and I do know that Gaza is not number one issue in the Israeli decision makers' agenda. And but I think that it is very important at the same time always to point on gaps, on problems, on points where your policy or your ideology is not perfect. I mean, mainly all the holes in the policy of the Hasdara, of the Hudna, because in the future, when you will, when we in Israel will sit and consider a much more serious and long-term policy regarding Gaza and not only tactic moves like today, I think that we should learn all the lessons from the past and to implement them. And one of the biggest lessons is that a player like Hamas, who the ruling party and the dominant player in Gaza, even as a ruling party, is not ready to give up his ideology. You can promote, you know, temporary ceasefire and Hudna, but you cannot achieve a long-term calm in Gaza as long as this radical ideological organization rules Gaza. And I think that when we will think about the ways to improve the situation in Gaza, and maybe, you know, there are all kinds of ideas, visions in Israel, how to implement the pattern of Singapore in Gaza, we must also consider the political and the ideological and the strategic level of who will rule Gaza, because you cannot think about or imagine the future of Gaza without analyzing those aspects.
Yeah, and I'd argue you can't, as much as Israeli policymakers would like this to be true, I don't think you can analyze Gaza and the future of Gaza without linking it to the wider Palestinian political arena, the competition between Hamas and Fatah, and what's happening in the West Bank. I think that should also come into play. But
no doubt,
Israeli governments generally, well, they don't like to focus about the Palestinian political issues in the West Bank.
They're trying to escape, run away from this point.
Yeah, they're trying to run away from the West Bank, and they're trying to keep Gaza quiet forever. And as we probably both agree, that's just not sustainable. Michael, to be continued with regard to Gaza, but before we finish, I wanted to ask you the question about tomorrow. So our listeners already know that we're recording this Wednesday afternoon, and tomorrow is the start of Jerusalem Day, or at least the flag march of the primarily religious nationalist movement through Jerusalem and through Damascus Gate and the Muslim quarter of the Old City. Historically very controversial march, led to clashes in Jerusalem. And in May of 2021, it at least contributed somewhat to the escalation with Hamas in Gaza directly, and that led to an 11-day war, as I'm sure we all remember. So predictions before tomorrow, since this podcast will likely go up as the tens of thousands of right-wingers are marching through Damascus Gate, and I'll be there. But what do you expect will happen tomorrow? Do you expect it to lead to some kind of escalation, whether in Jerusalem, the West Bank, or even in Gaza?
Well, actually, it's a guess, Neri, because you know,
we don't know.
We cannot really know every development that will take place tomorrow. But you know, I think that all options are open, because it also depends on what will happen in the streets of the old city of Jerusalem, nearby the Temple Mount, in every corner in Jerusalem. Of course, if there will be clashes, even violent clashes, between those who will take place in the Flags March and the Palestinians in Jerusalem, I think that the likelihood of escalation, even launch of rockets from Gaza toward Israel, will be higher. And by the way, we are focused only on the events in Jerusalem, but we should remember that almost every day there is an operation of IDF in one of the Palestinian cities in the West Bank, mainly in the northern parts of Samaria, Nablus, and Jenin, and there are almost every day casualties among the organizations, mainly the Islamic Jihad. And I think that this could be, you know, a spark, a trigger, almost every day to launch rockets toward Israel. And the lesson we should learn from this situation is that actually the deterrence of organizations such as the Islamic Jihad from the last round of escalation is very limited and very short. You know, we are speaking about the negative or severe scenarios tomorrow. And this also shows that we deeply inside ourselves, inside our consciousness, we do know that the deterrence or the change that was made as a result of the last operation is very limited. And of course, unfortunately, if Israel won't change dramatically its policy toward Gaza, so it will find itself once and again and again and again in the same events, and a change should be done.
Yeah, I guess that's a really good point that you raised, that if Israel, as the politicians claim, so successfully restored deterrence via this last Gaza operation, then why is there a heightened risk of rockets being fired from Gaza just a few days later?
Refrain.
Yeah. And I've been telling people the last couple of days that while the flag march is highly controversial and inflammatory, and if you actually see what happens on the ground, especially in the old city in East Jerusalem, it's quite disgraceful how the right wingers on the Jewish side act towards the local Palestinians. In years past, that's all been true, but we have to remember last year the flag march was allowed to go through Damascus Gate, through the Muslim quarter, to the Western Wall, and no rockets were fired from Gaza. There weren't even really any clashes on the side streets of East Jerusalem. I was there. It was actually all pretty calm, if still quite disgraceful. And the year before, in May of 2021, which everybody points to, people forget that Bibi Netanyahu actually caved at the last minute and rerouted the flag march away from Damascus Gate through Jaffa Gate. And yet Hamas still decided to fire six rockets at Jerusalem. And so I think ultimately the decision is with our friend Yahya Sinwar, how he decides to play tomorrow, no matter what happens on the streets of Jerusalem, I'd argue.
I agree with you.
But we'll have to wait and see. And our listeners will be a lot smarter than we are, because they'll probably be listening to this as the flag march is happening. So TBD. Mikhail, thank you so much for the time, and we look forward to having you on again soon.
Thank you for having me, Neri.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay, take care.
Okay, thanks again to Mikhail Milstein for his generous time and insights. Also, a special thanks to our producer, Jacob Gilman, and to all of you who support Israel Policy Forum's work, including this podcast. You know who you are. Just remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave a rating and comment. That always helps. And as always, thank you for listening.